Last week, we discussed unions as a key organization in democracy. Just to remind you of the way that whole discussion was framed, was not primarily in terms of the way unions directly help their own members in their economic lives, although I think, of course, that's also important, was rather the role of unions in making a democracy more vibrant because of the way it provides a more organic connection between people in their everyday life, of which the workplace is one critical component, a connection between that and broader politics. In a country like the United States, there are a variety of organic institutions which play that kind of role. And another one is churches. Churches do play that role. People come together every week from different places, different walks of life. They come together. They congregate. We call it a congregation. It's an occasion for people to express their solidarities and interact around those solidarities. And that's a natural foundation for them to also engage collectively politically. Well, unions have played that role historically, but in the last 40 or 50 years, they've weakened, both because of changes in the law. It's made it easier for employers to resist unions, and because of changes in the practices of the institutions that are meant to support unions. The National Labor Relations Board has become a much less effective instrument for enforcing whatever rules there are. Well, today, if you've been following the news, today in Michigan, the state legislature is on the verge of voting. The prediction is they will vote today to pass what are called a right to work law for the state of Michigan. And I thought it would be important for me to really clarify what's going on there, what are the stakes and what this all means. The label for these laws, right to work, sounds really great, right? It's one of these cases where using language in a particular way helps to set the stage for a debate, but in a way that biases the discussion in one direction or another. Who could be opposed to the right to work? You know, you can't stand up and say, I'm opposed to the right to work, right? Everybody's in favor of the right to work. An alternative name for these laws would be the right to be a free rider, the right to be a moocher on the sacrifices of others, right? The right to be a free rider, that doesn't quite have the same, you know, appeal as the right to work. So here's the basic idea. If unions are successful and organize a workforce at a workplace or in a company, they provide some certain kinds of collective benefits for everybody who works in that company, not just for the people who have joined the union in the first place. Right? If they are a successful union, they raise wages. If you remember that chart from the discussion, the average wages of unionized workers in the same kinds of occupations and sectors are 30% more or less on average than workers in non-unionized sectors. So they're providing benefits for everyone. They provide grievance procedures, they provide higher wages, greater benefits, they provide all these benefits, and they provide it whether or not you're a union member. Now, which is the more stable arrangement? A set of rules which says once a union is established and forms a contract, that is, once they've gone through that process, have formed a contract, from then on, everyone who works in that place has to join the union. They have to pay dues. They don't have to be active. They don't have to go to meetings. You know, they don't have to be an active member of the union, but they have to contribute to the union since the union is providing benefits and protections for them. But that's no longer a free choice of people who choose to work in that workplace. That's one kind of situation. The other kind of situation is, from then on, anybody can work in that workplace and they don't have to pay union dues. Now, some people who will join the work, who will be employed, will nevertheless pay union dues out of a sense of obligation. they will feel, yes, this union is providing these benefits, I'm going to pay the dues. But over time, what tends to happen is people forget that the benefits which they receive are the result of the presence of a union. They become taken for granted. Of course, we have health insurance. Of course, we have grievance procedures. This is just the way the workplace is organized. And new workers become less and less likely over time to see the connection between the fact that there's a union and the fact that they have these benefits. And because of economic pressures in people's private lives, and because union dues aren't trivial, they are an expense, workers will be tempted to keep the benefits and not pay the dues. It's a bit like the controversy at University of Wisconsin over segregated student fees, right? Some of you, this is a controversy that comes up every few years. Students have to pay these segregated fees. They go to fund student government and a variety of student organizations and activities. It creates a kind of resource base under the control of students to provide various kinds of collective goods for students. You have to pay the segregated fees. They're not just a charitable contribution on your part. Imagine what the level of funding for student organizations would be if segregated fees were voluntary. You know, if you just pay them if you wanted to. It would just mean a collapse of student government and a collapse of student-funded activities. There'd be some, particularly those that cater to the particular narrow interests of people who have extra money, right? So some students would still support various student organizations because they care about them and because they would have the extra funds to devote just to the thing they want, not to the general process of having student activities. Imagine if athletics at the university, so to speak, were paid just by voluntary contributions. You know, we'd have intramural sports, ultimate frisbee. We would not have intramural sports. Well, for all these reasons, collective goods tend to be paid by resources, if they're going to be stable and at a high level, they're going to be paid by resources which are not entirely voluntary, the contributions. Well, that's the way unions have been stabilized. In those states that institute these so-called right-to-work laws, the decline of unions has been way more rapid than in states like Michigan and still Wisconsin that have not passed right-to-work laws. What the Michigan legislature is going to do is basically accelerate the attack on the labor movement overall. Michigan has a relatively strong labor movement. It plays a very active role in Michigan politics. It's a counterweight to the role of corporations and corporate money in politics. That counterweight in Michigan will be severely undermined by the passage of these laws. And this is just another instance where there is an erosion of the vibrancy of American democracy. It's also notable in the Michigan case that this law is being passed in December after an election. Michigan, like Wisconsin, has suffered from the severe gerrymandering of state legislative districts after the 2010 census and the wave of Republican victories in state legislatures and governorships in 2010. Michigan, like Wisconsin, voted heavily for Obama in the last election. And Michigan, like Wisconsin, had more Democratic votes for state legislators than Republican votes. But nevertheless, the state legislature remains controlled by Republicans in both houses and the governor. The extent of that control, however, was reduced in the last election. And the decision to pass this law now, rather than wait until January when the new legislature comes in, is there was some concern that in January it would be harder to pass it. That in January with the new legislature, with new people just recently elected, and with a thinner Republican majority in the Michigan legislature, the bill might not pass. Another instance of this relatively sorry state of American democracy. Well, I've been specializing in gloom and doom in these discussions. Let's now turn to hopeful signs. Democracy from below. New ways, and sometimes some old ways, in which democracy is being revitalized, where democracy continues to have strong and vibrant representation in the lives of ordinary people. In a way, you know, the expression of this for this lecture, and the title of the chapter in the book that corresponds to it, Democracy from Below, it's kind of a redundant expression, right? I mean, democracy is rule from below. That's what it means, rule by the people. So to use the expression democracy from below, it's kind of a redundancy. It should be a redundancy. The reason we put that in the title of the chapter of the book is, of course, to emphasize that the kind of democracy we have is not always from below. It's a democracy that does not always empower ordinary people in their ordinary lives. It's a democracy that's thin and that's manipulated by elites, that's governed by private sources of power rather than by common public concern. And that's why we gave the title. Is my little clicker thing not working? Ah. The mysteries. Okay, I'll have to do it the mechanical way. The discussion today is going to be built around a contrast between two different kinds of institutional arrangements through which the idea of rule by the people is accomplished. The most familiar one is representative democracy. This is what we all think of mostly when we talk about democracy. In a representative system, ordinary people elect politicians who make public decisions on their behalf. We elect our representatives and confer upon them the power to make decisions. Any complex, large democratic system has to have representative institutions. So my argument here is not that we can substitute direct democracy, a democracy in which ordinary people are directly involved in the ongoing way of making decisions. They are exercising power directly. I'm not proposing that we can imagine a complex, large modern society like the United States governed entirely through institutions of direct democracy, but rather that it's possible to have a much greater arena of direct democracy, of direct participation by ordinary people in democratic life, and that the institutions of direct democracy can then be fitted together with institutions of representative democracy in a way that makes the whole system more vibrantly and robustly democratic. I'm going to focus then in this discussion of democracy from below on various aspects of the problem or ways in which we can think of democratic institutions involving direct democracy, not just representative democracy. Oh, this isn't going to work. So here's some familiar examples of direct democracy. These are examples that exist in different ways throughout American society. In a way, the most familiar form of direct democracy is the jury. Think about what a jury is. A jury is a random assemblance, a random selection of ordinary citizens, not elites, not people with any special expertise, just ordinary people, get randomly selected, and they are empowered to make certain critical decisions involving the use of state power. In criminal cases, they decide whether a person is guilty or innocent of an accusation. In civil cases, they get to decide what the balance of the evidence is for and against some civil suit. In certain cases, such as the long drawn out suits against large tobacco industry, the large tobacco companies that dragged on for decades, in those suits, when you think about it, these were really powerful corporations that had been deliberately and systematically lying in their congressional testimonies and in their advertising about the health risks of smoking. They knew decades before they were forced to admit it. They knew from their own internal research that smoking was a significant cause of cancer. But they denied it in their advertising. They denied it in public hearings. They simply lied. And they figured that the costs that they might eventually have to face because of lying were less than the profits they would make during the period when they were lying. It's a simple cost-benefit analysis, the kind of thing that a profit-maximizing firm does. They weigh the costs and benefits. In this case, the costs of being honest, lower profits, versus the benefits, paying some fines eventually. Well, this is, in my view, bad behavior on the part of corporations. They got away with it for decades. But who ultimately decided that they were guilty? Ordinary people sitting on a jury, hearing the evidence on both sides of the case. That's a really significant delegation of power. And not every country does it this way. Not every democratic country. We have a wider use of juries in which rich and powerful people are being judged by ordinary folk. We have a wider use of juries than most countries in the world, including most highly democratic countries. It's one of the strengths of the American judicial system, is the jury system. We kind of take it for granted. You know, it's a little shocking when you go to a country and cases are decided by a three-judge panel, ordinary criminal cases or ordinary civil cases, rather than by a jury. We believe that ordinary people should have that power. Well, that's an example of direct democracy. Referenda is another example. In some states, not in Wisconsin, but in some states, ordinary citizens can get together, have a petition drive, and get a law put on the ballot in which fellow citizens can simply vote. Do we want this law or not? Now, sometimes this leads to really stupid laws. I mean, you know, you can imagine what happens sometimes. Other times, it's an avenue for ordinary people to have the will of the people translated into public policy. In the recent election, a couple of states in the United States voted to decriminalize possession of marijuana. They figured, weighing the evidence after decades of the war on drugs and the consequences in the lives of people of mere possession of marijuana, that marijuana simply shouldn't be a criminal offense. Possessing marijuana shouldn't be a criminal offense. And Colorado and the state of Washington have decriminalized marijuana. A couple of states also passed same-sex marriage laws, that feeling that it's the time has come that if same-sex couples want to marry, they should have all the rights of heterosexual couples with respect to the things which the legal status of marriage provides. Well, these were the results of direct initiatives from below. Sometimes, however, these referenda lead to really problematic laws. There was there's a famous instance on the West Coast. All the states, Oregon, Washington, California, have very open referenda laws. So sometimes it happens on ballots, there'll be 20 laws that citizens have to vote on. And as you recall from our discussion of rational ignorance, you can imagine how well informed many voters are about the content of some of these laws. They get their information from the cheapest source. What's the cheapest source for political information? Advertisements. And sometimes the ad wars on television around referenda are every bit as weird and distorted and intense as the ad wars around political candidates. Well, there was a case in Washington where there were two propositions on the ballot, both about what is called ergonomic safety in the workplace. That has to do with a particular aspect of occupational safety and health that concerns the physical arrangements within offices, especially, that can create hazards like carpal tunnel syndrome and other things. So there was a set of laws proposed to improve the enforcement of ergonomic standards. One of them was sponsored by industry, and it was called the Ergonomic Safety Referendum or whatever. I don't remember the exact title. And it wanted to reduce the enforcement of the rules. And the other was called virtually the same name, the Ergonomic Safety Initiative. And it wanted to tighten them. So people had to vote on two, and they both passed. Right? They both passed. I think the evidence is because citizens were responding to the labels, which seemed positive, ergonomic safety. But one reduced regulations and one increased regulations. I believe in that case, when both pass, the one that gets the most votes is the one that becomes law. And I don't actually know the punchline of this weird story. I don't know which law actually passed in this particular case. Well, it should be initiative and referenda. They're two different kinds of procedures. That's another example of direct democracy. Public hearings are certainly an important aspect of direct democracy. In cities in the United States, it's standard procedure that when the city council is considering some new ordinance, they hold public hearings. School boards hold public hearings when there's some new initiative that's going on in the schools. Ordinary citizens line up and they speak. That's a very deep and old American tradition. Many countries do not have public hearings where ordinary citizens can speak for routine public policy matters. That's a deep and important part of our traditions of democracy. And there are instances where the fact that there is a venue where people can speak their minds functions as a catalyst for collective action. People come together for those meetings, they meet other people coming for those meetings, and that forms the basis for them coming together to actually act in concert, not just as separate individual citizens. Public issue campaigns periodically erupt in the United States around issues of public importance, in which people demonstrate and mobilize, lobby, engage in popular bottom-up politics around some issue, rather than just elite-driven. In New England, there's an old tradition in small towns called the New England Town Meeting. This has declined over time, but it still exists in some places in Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine, I think in Massachusetts as well. There are town meetings. The town meeting is an annual or biannual event in which the budget for the city is reviewed. There's public discussion and vote over the basic shape of the budget for the town, rather than having budgets discussed and decided exclusively by elected officials. And finally, as a kind of classic example, indeed probably the best known besides juries, example of democracy from below, of direct citizens being involved in efforts to directly affect public policy, there is the big category of things called social protests. What I'd like to do here is just an interlude about the Wisconsin protests of 2011. How many of you here went to at least one demonstration at the state capitol, sort of saw this? I mean, I know this would be before many of you were in Madison. So some of you have a direct personal sense of what that event was like. For those of you who weren't there, some of you weren't even in the country, I know some of you are foreign students, the occupation of the state capitol building in Wisconsin in 2011 was the longest occupation of a governmental building in American history. There's been no other instance like that, where for 17 days, the official site, physical building of state government was physically occupied by protesters. I was up at the Capitol, not every day, but most days. Many of my students were deeply involved in organizing those events. In fact, the Teaching Assistants Association, in which sociologists played a very key role, the Graduate Student Association of Teaching Assistants, were really the primary movers for organizing the internal life of the occupation of the state capital. Very heavily involved. So I was there frequently and took lots of photos. So I'm going to give you a little slideshow of the protests, just to remind you what this was all about, without going into a lot of detail. Scott Walker was elected in November of 2010. In January of 2011, he got through the legislature, which was then controlled by both houses, by Republicans. He got them to pass tax cuts for corporations, which ended up producing a budget deficit. So prior to him being elected, there was a budget surplus in Wisconsin. He passed right away these tax cuts for corporations. That produced a budget deficit. State governments aren't allowed, states aren't allowed to have budget deficits. They have to balance their budgets. So suddenly we had a budget crisis. When you have a budget crisis, there's a special kind of legislative procedure called a budget repair bill, which is a kind of emergency measure to make adjustments either by raising taxes or cutting programs in order to balance the budget in a given cycle of budgetary spending. The budget repair bill then was triggered by the tax cuts, which produced the deficit that then required some adjustment. In the budget repair bill, the governor inserted a set of provisions to destroy public sector unions. The nature of those provisions was not merely to force wage cuts in order to balance the budget. The unions agreed to all the proposed wage cuts, so that was not an issue. It was rather to simply destroy the unions. The provisions required the unions to have a majority of the employees, not of people who vote, but of the total population of the employees in a workplace, to vote every year for the union. Normally, majority vote systems are a majority of the voters decide an election. This had to be a majority of the employees. So if 70% of the employees voted and 65% of the voters voted for the union, the election would fail because of the 30% who didn't vote. It has to be 50% of all voters. You had to vote every year, and the union was not allowed to bargain about anything other than wages, and only up to the rate of inflation. So the union would have no power to negotiate anything about the workplace, about working conditions, or about wages beyond simply the rate of inflation. And finally, the union was not allowed to automatically collect union dues. Union members had to individually, voluntarily give the union dues. There was no automatic check-off, automatic payment of union dues. Well, if that bill passed, it would mean in the long term public sector unions would collapse in Wisconsin. Wisconsin, by the way, was the first state to recognize public sector unions in the 1950s, and therefore, symbolically, it was an attack on the oldest tradition of public sector unions, which for most of that period had very cooperative and collaborative relationships with the state government. Well, that triggered these protests, and here are just pictures. Let me dim the lights a little more for this. I'm going to go through these fairly quickly. Some of these images will be familiar to many of you. Some of you were there on the floor of the Capitol building. The Wisconsin Capitol building is one of the most fantastic in the country. It's really a stunningly beautiful building. And without it being by design, it was perfect for this kind of gathering because of the galleries that overlook the central hallway. Wonderful posters all over the building, gathering of people from all over the state. The state motto in Wisconsin, for those of you who don't know, is forward. Wisconsin forward, not backward. I went to Iraq and came home to Egypt. The occupation of the state capital was exactly at the same time as the events in Egypt in Tahrir Square, where there were big demonstrations to topple the government. Democracy is two wolves and a sheep voting on what to have for lunch. Liberty is a well-armed sheep contesting the vote. Lots of imaginative posters. Five states in the U.S. specifically prohibit collective bargaining for teachers. Their rankings on ACT are 44th, 47th, 48th, 49th, and 50th. Wisconsin is currently tied for second. The law that was passed prohibits collective bargaining for teachers. That aspect of the law, by the way, has been overturned by us in a state court because of the way in which it meant that the state was prohibiting local authorities from allowing teachers' unions. That will be appealed to the state Supreme Court. I think it's under appeal right now. We don't know yet what will happen at that stage. Ian's Pizza, this is a famous episode of the occupation. Ian's Pizza brought pizzas one night to the demonstrators in the Capitol, and National Public Radio picked up on that as a kind of human interest story. The local pizza place closing up has leftover pizza, brings it to the state capitol, and Ian's Pizza then began getting orders for pizza from around the world. And from every state in the United States. This is a list of the places in which people called up and using a credit card ordered pizza for the people inside the state capitol building. That's a statue of Bob La Follette, a famous early 20th century progressive politician in Wisconsin, kind of a symbol of Wisconsin progressivism. What would Bob do was one of the slogans. People slept overnight, of course, and had these nests. There were sort of nests in various places. Did anybody here sleep overnight? Anybody here? One of my big regrets, I was there almost every day, and I'm not sure why. I suppose it's creaky joints and, you know, whatever. I didn't sleep over. I really should have, just so I could have said, and you know, it was really great at 2 o'clock in the morning. This was what was called the Situation Room. A lot of the people in this room are graduate students in sociology. I don't know if Emmanuel is in any of these. In any of the pictures, I mean. Lauren would have been, but he wasn't yet a graduate student in the sociology department here 2 years ago. Testify, the pretense under which the building was occupied was that the state assembly was holding hearings over the law, and there was a rule that said as long as there were people who wanted to speak, the hearings would continue, and as long as there was public hearings in the building would remain open. And so there was a lot of mobilization in order to ensure that there would be continual, perpetual hearings, that people would be testifying. It began with a 2-minute time limit for each testimony. That got relaxed over time. After the first 17 hours of testimony, the Republicans in the state assembly walked out and said they didn't want to hear any more testimony. There were still people in line waiting to testify at that point, including members of the Teaching Assistant Association. The Democratic Assemblyman said, yes, we'll continue holding the hearings as long as there are people who will continue to testify. So the students mobilized their friends using social media and other devices, got people to come to the state capitol in the middle of the night. And that's really how the whole process began. Now, just as a personal anecdote, after about maybe a week or 10 days, I hadn't testified. Now, I hadn't testified. That wasn't exactly a decision. I just hadn't thought about it. And it's not something which I have done. I haven't gone to public meetings of that sort, officially organized by state legislature, to give my testimony. So naturally, one of my graduate students who was patrolling the hallways and buttonholing everybody and saying, "Have you testified? Have you testified?" They came up to me and I sheepishly admitted that I hadn't testified. And I would say literally rather than metaphorically, you know, I was sort of taken by the shirt and said, "Okay, come on, over here to testify." So I went to the hearing room, put my name down on a list, and was told that I should come back in about an hour and a half. That's how many people were ahead of me in line to get into the room, and that in the room it would take somewhere between 1 and 2 hours for me to get through. So I came back and went into the room to testify. And I have to say, for me, it was one of the most moving things I've ever done in my life of activism and politics. And it was unexpected. I figured, you know, this would be a kind of pro forma thing, right? People were going to go up and they would say something just to keep the committee meeting. That the purpose was not actually to testify at that point. It was just to keep the process going. I hadn't anticipated it being a really moving and powerful personal experience for me. So here's this, what the scene was. There are about maybe, I don't know, 30 people ahead of me. I don't remember exactly. So I had to wait quite a while, 25, something like that. Each of them went to the head of the table with a microphone and spoke for a few minutes about why this was important to them. They were from every conceivable part of the state. People were coming from Superior, from Green Bay, from Eau Claire, from just all over the state, from all different walks of life. Some were laborers, some were nurses, some were teachers, some were students, some were recent immigrants, speaking about how in their high school, there was one high school kid who testified while I was there, the first person in his family ever to graduate from high school, a recent immigrant, and saying how the dedication of his teachers had really made all the difference in the world because his family wasn't able to give him the kind of support. A young mother with an autistic 3-year-old who had been getting intensive therapy through Badger Care, the Wisconsin supplemental health insurance programs to help families who would not qualify under ordinary conditions for Medicaid, that is, they earned too much money to get health support for the poor, but if they have extraordinary needs, such as having an autistic child, they could get this extra support. One of the things that the budget repair bill cut was the extra support for families who needed that kind of intensive therapy. So this young mother was talking about what a fantastic difference it had made to the lives of her son and the lives of her family, and how this was all in jeopardy because of the budget repair bill, in which the budget cuts are targeted at those programs which most serve the needs of ordinary people, not those programs which serve the interests of elites. One after another, I listened. And I had this sense of being part of a community and sharing with fellow citizens, and a sense of actually, and this was something I hadn't really experienced before, I had a sense of being a citizen of Wisconsin, not just an American. You know, my sense of being part of this community was enhanced tremendously by the 2 hours I spent listening to people tell their stories, share their experiences in the way they did. I mean, I've lived here since 1976, but I've always kind of felt this as a great place to live. It's a fantastic university, but my identity was, this was my base of operations. You know, this was where I was located, but I felt more of a kind of cosmopolitan that was as comfortable going to Paris to give a lecture, going to Beijing to do some research. I mean, I've traveled all around the world with my projects, and I always came back to Madison because it was a nice place to rest between trips, so to speak. I mean, that's an exaggeration. I do spend more time here than I do gallivanting about. But I didn't really feel that kind of connection in my identity to the place until after this experience with the occupation, and especially this very pointed set of moments in the hearings. When I got up to testify, I put on my professorial hat and talked about the things that we've been talking about here. I talked about how critical the labor movement and unions were to the vibrancy of democracy, and pointed out that in Poland in the early 1980s, when the Solidarity movement, the union movement in Poland, was challenging authorities, once they decided to put an end to the democratic movement that was occurring in Poland, what was the first thing that the government did? It banned unions. The very first thing the government did. And during that period, what did the United States criticize the Polish government for doing? Banning unions. And that was what was happening in Wisconsin. Testify. I recommend it as an experience, not just because it's a way of contributing to the political life of the communities in which you live. It's a way of engaging in activities which also transform yourself and your own sense of who you are and how you fit in the world to play that more active role as a citizen. Okay, more pictures. There was a family daycare center set up by the students inside the Capitol building so parents could come with little kids and be free to participate in the demonstrations. I'll just run through these quickly. Firefighters for Labor, that was one of the really cool things. I'm sure many of you who are in Madison saw this character. I don't know who he was. This was February. And it wasn't a warm February. At the very end of the whole process, there was a tractorcade that went around the state capitol building at the very last. Very creative signs, posters. Ballerinas for Fairness. What's sweeter than that? Walker referred to the demonstrators as union thugs, and it became a kind of self-proclaimed motto. We are all union thugs. And here, what I want to do is just briefly, Forgot to plug in the sound. Oh, this is the wrong one. Just a second. Sorry. This is the next one. Let me plug this in. Here we go. This is a little video I made as well. Just a collection of clips. Are we getting sound? Let's see. The sound is going to come in a second. I'm going to put the sound up so you'll hear it about what it was actually like. That became a constant sort of symbolic horn. For those of you who don't know, that's the flag of the United Farm Workers Union. I don't know why it was there particularly. Thank you. well, something is, well, there's not much left anyway on it, so that's all right. As you all know, the final playing out of the story was not one that you would maybe expect, having seen the intensity of the demonstrations. There was last year a recall drive for Scott Walker, which failed in the final election where people had to decide after gathering over 1 million signatures. Exit polls after the recall election indicated that about 17% of people who voted against the recall, that is, voted for Walker in the recall election, said that they planned to vote for Obama the following November, and that they voted for Walker because they didn't like the idea of a recall. So I don't think the election of Walker in the recall election indicates support for his policies, but rather a skepticism on the part of some voters. And that's a skepticism which is understandable. I don't think that represents some, you know, confusion on people's part. It's a reasonable political position to take, that I strongly oppose these policies, but I don't think we should have a recall. And that's how that played out. Just so you know, I made this film. I put together the clips because I was asked to give a talk in Athens, Greece, a year ago, about the Wisconsin protests. And I presented, you know, the slideshow and this. And I emphasized that when people occupied the state capitol building, the graduate students who were kind of organizing it organized brigades to keep the place clean. They used blue masking tape so they wouldn't mark the walls. And one of the chants was a call and response: whose house is this? It's our house. What is it called? The people's house. The people in Greece, I gave this at a public lecture with 200 or 300 people present, many of whom were involved in the protests over austerity in Greece. They were really astounded. They were blown away by the political culture in Wisconsin. For them, the first thing you would do if you occupied a state government building would be to trash it. That what you would approach the purpose of protest was to raise the costs to elites to oppose you. And you would do that by breaking windows, putting graffiti on the walls, basically destroying the physical place, rather than protecting it and claiming it as your own. And in the conversations with people there, they expressed this surprise. And actually, they were impressed. I mean, it wasn't just surprise. How could you be so stupid not to trash the place? It was, what an achievement to have still a belief in democratic possibility and in democracy as our government, not their government. There was really a kind of respect for that political culture, which I hadn't really thought about. That was another one of these situations where, by virtue of sharing my experiences with others, in this case the Wisconsin experience with protesters in Athens, Greece, by sharing it with others, you learn more about yourself and about your own traditions because of the contrast. That's a sort of general social science point as well as human point. You learn about what your world is like by understanding how different and variable the world can be. And that is an achievement. It is an achievement of democracy from below. It's an achievement that we still hold on to in the US. It's an achievement which is at present under serious strain. In the months ahead in Wisconsin, there is likely to be renewed intensity of conflict. I kind of doubt if there'll be another occupation of the state capitol, but who knows. The governor seems to be proposing eliminating same-day voter registration in Wisconsin. Wisconsin and Minnesota and a couple of other states have same-day registration and have the highest rates of voting of any place in the country. You can guarantee if you get rid of same-day registration, you're going to reduce voting. And why get rid of same-day registration? It works smoothly. There's no problems. There's no evidence of frauds. The only reason to get rid of same-day registration is because you want to reduce voting. You want to make it harder for people to vote. That's likely to be proposed, at least that's the indications at the present. And given the political complexion of the state legislatures, again, because of gerrymandering, not because of popular vote, it's entirely possible that the same-day registration will be eliminated in Wisconsin. It's also, it seems to me, entirely possible that Walker is going to propose right-to-work laws for Wisconsin as well. That the anti-union bills of last year were just directed at public sector unions. The next stage is to direct it against all unions. I would expect, although of course I don't know for sure, that laws like in Michigan will get passed, will get proposed here. These are all erosions of democracy from below, and we may then see a renewal of these kinds of protests. We don't have much time left for the rest of the material I wanted to present. Most of this is also in the chapter in the book, and just to repeat something I've said at various times in the course, the book is the material, and then the lecture is meant to reinforce particular ideas and themes. So you should take seriously the task of actually reading the chapter and not just relying on what I say here, since I'm not going to be able to cover all the things I wanted to. So here's the question. Can arenas of direct participatory democracy be meaningfully expanded in a complex society? Can we build on this idea of democracy from below, direct democracy? Are there ways we can involve citizens more actively as a counterweight to elites? There's one very innovative example from Brazil, which is now being imported to the United States. And this is a kind of interesting historical, new historical phenomenon. Historically, the United States has been the center for innovation of democratic institutions, and we've exported them. Other countries have copied them. Sometimes we've exported them deliberately. We have imposed them on other countries, but often we've been copied. This is a case where there was a very interesting and dynamic innovation in Brazil, which first spread to various places elsewhere in Latin America, and then to various European countries, and now is being copied in modified form in certain cities in the United States. It's called participatory budgeting. And here's the basic idea. I'll give you just the thinnest description. City governments typically organize the production of their budgets by having a planning office, which is staffed by political appointees of the mayor, and who prepare a city budget. The mayor submits it to a city council. The city council then mucks about with the budget in whatever way it wants to, passes it, and then it gets signed by the mayor. That's the typical way that budgets get determined. In the city of Porto Alegre in the late 1980s and early 1990s, a novel way of building up city budgets was created, in which the core of the city budget was produced by neighborhood assemblies throughout the city. So people would meet in open meetings where anybody could come. Out of those meetings, budget committees would be formed to work on particular budget problems. They would then come back to a general assembly of the neighborhood with a set of budget priorities, which they would then collectively vote on. And then they would choose delegates for a citywide budget assembly that would bring all these proposals from all over the city to produce a unified budget. And only at that point would the budget get submitted to the city council for ratification. This was a complete and total mess the first couple of years they did it. The political party that was elected at the time in Porto Alegre, the Workers' Party, is now the governing party of the country. At the time, it wasn't. This was just after Brazil had exited from a many decades dictatorship. They didn't know how to run a city. They didn't know how to run a budget. It was a complete chaotic mess the first couple of years. But eventually, they figured out routines and ways of doing this, of both organizing these neighborhood assemblies so that people could actually participate and not just blow off steam, and then bring all the assemblies together to create a coherent budget. The result in Porto Alegre was a dramatic transformation of the priorities of the budget. Before the participatory budget, if you looked at different neighborhoods and assessed how much was being spent on that neighborhood per capita and what the average income of people was per capita, that correlation was positive. The richer the neighborhood, the more got spent on the neighborhood per person. After the participatory budget, the correlation becomes negative. The poorer the neighborhood, the more the city spends on it. A dramatic transformation in the way the priorities. You pave streets in the slums before you improve parks in the rich neighborhoods, basically. Let me just show you some pictures. I'll just run quickly. These are posters around the city to announce the participatory budget assemblies. I went to a bunch of them when I was in Porto Alegre. It was part of my research on participatory budgeting. At these neighborhood assemblies, it's also an occasion for performances by arts programs of kids in the neighborhood. The city council and mayor's office comes to these meetings to present the results of the previous year's budget priorities and to say which ones have been finished, which priorities are still in progress. And these are just pictures of of activities in the meetings. I won't show you the video of Chicago. Chicago is experimenting with participatory budgeting. Joe Moore is an alder person, or I guess in Chicago it's city councilman, right? Yeah, city councilman, in the 49th ward. He heard about the participatory budget in Porto Alegre and had the following idea. City councilmen in Chicago each have a discretionary budget of about $1.5 million a year that they can spend on anything they want to. It has to be spent on infrastructure, on building things. They can't, of course, just put it in their own pockets. They can't also just use it to hire more staff. They have to build things with it. So you can fill potholes, you can build bike racks, you can build improve parks, you can improve city lighting. You can do anything that involves infrastructure. So what Joe Moore decided to do was to allocate his entire $1.6 million through a participatory budget. He told all the members of his constituency, I think it's the ward had about 70,000 people, and said on such and such a date there's going to be a big meeting, and at this meeting we'll set up committees of people to think about projects that they want to use this $1.6 million for. And after all these projects get developed and get costed out, so we know how much they'll cost, we'll then have kind of like a science fair. You know, we'll have a big gymnasium where all these projects will be on display, and anybody in the neighborhood can come, review all the projects, and rank order their preferences. And then we'll gather the rank ordered preferences, and we'll just pay for as many as we can do, starting with the highest priority on down. This was very successful. This was about 4 years ago. Extremely successful experiment. What Joe Moore told me is the priorities for how the money got spent were utterly different from when he did it on his own. So he thought of himself as this really, you know, popular, he was a very popular politician. He had his ear to the ground, very responsive to his constituents. He told me that he spent about 85% of his discretionary budget on potholes. Now, you can imagine why that happens, right? I mean, he's sitting in his office, and some constituent calls him up and says, "Hey, Joe, there's this terrible pothole, happens to be in front of my house. What do you say? Can you get it fixed? And he looks at his discretionary budget and says, sure, I've got enough money to fix that. So he sends a work order over to the street department. When he used that money by responding to members of his constituency one by one, people called him up to propose things that were good for them as individuals. When you create a democratic space where people come together to discuss, okay, we got $1.6 million. What's the best way we can do this to enhance our community? They didn't say, oh, let's just fill all the potholes. Out of that deliberation, that public collective discussion, people thought about collective needs, what's good for all of us as a community, and they came up with very different kinds of civic improvements using the $1.6 million available. Since that first experiment in Chicago, last year in New York, four city council districts tried an experiment, pretty much on the same lines. I'm part of a kind of national foundation called the Participatory Budget Project, which provides information and consulting services to cities that are trying to develop participatory budgets. So I was in New York for the public meetings after the projects had been developed, the day when the voting took place. I went to Spanish Harlem, which I had never been to before, in the Upper East Side of Chicago, of New York City, Manhattan. And there was this big public space. I think it was a gymnasium of some sort. I'm not sure if it was part of a school or some kind of community center. And there were 20 or so projects around the walls. It would be a room maybe a little bigger than this. And representatives from the committees that had developed each of these projects was there to discuss with people as they went around and decided how to rank order their preferences. Next year, I believe there will be 12 districts in New York City that are going to use their discretionary money to build participatory budgets. So participatory budgeting, I think, is a really interesting idea. Now, you can see how it could be just window dressing. It could be just a way to get citizens involved in peanuts, in just allocating little bits and pieces of the budget and making them feel better about their city government without actually changing anything important. So it's possible, like any kind of reform, that it serves more symbolic purposes than real democratic purposes. That's possible. But it's also possible that this is one small way of contributing to a change in the way ordinary citizens think about their relationship to city government as one in which it's their resources and they should be involved in the collective allocation and priority setting for the use of those resources. I think it's a very exciting prospect. My prediction is that in the next decade, many cities will adopt participatory budgeting. In some places, it will be a way of letting people divert their energies into small projects. But in some places, it will become the basis of civic revitalization around a new model for how direct participation in democratic life can take place. Next Thursday is our last lecture. We will talk about possible futures. See you then.